back to the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome. And if you just joined us, I wanted to let you know that this is a two-hour show which balances the intellectual and the creative, where we try to explore if we have more in common than divides us. In the first hour of the show, we ask questions that matter, avoiding politics, instead focusing on the issues that underlie politics and current events, issues that affect us all, young or old, locally and globally. In this, the second hour, we feature in-depth interviews with local, national and international guests from the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways that we engage with the world. It's all a question of balance. If you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. There's podcasts there of all my past shows, and you can also connect with me on social media should you wish. itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing one of the world's most prolific and popular best-selling authors, Alexander McCall Smith. Alexander has written more than 100 books, including specialist academic titles, short story collections, and a number of very popular children's books. He is best known for his internationally acclaimed number one ladies detective agency series, which rapidly rose to the top of bestseller lists throughout the world and has now been translated into 40 languages and has sold over 20 million copies worldwide. The number one ladies detective agency has also been made into a television series starring Jill Scott and produced by the Weinstein Company, with the first episode directed by Anthony Minghella. Alexander has had a varied career, spending his earlier life as a professor of medical law, working in universities in the UK and abroad. Born in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and educated there and in Scotland, Alexander first returned to Africa to work in Botswana, the setting of his beloved series, The Number One Ladies Detective Agency, to set up a new law school at the University of Botswana, co-writing what remains the only book on the country's legal system, The Criminal Law of Botswana. After his incredible literary success, Alexander left academia to focus on the writing of fiction. A self-confessed serial novelist, Alexander is the author of several other best-selling series, including the Sunday Philosophy Club series, featuring amateur Edinburgh sleuth Isabel Dalhousie, the Scotland Street novels, chronicling the lives of the colourful characters of an Edinburgh boarding house, the Corduroy Mansion series, depicting the lives of the delightfully eccentric residents of a large house in Pimlico, London, and the Von Igelfeld series, portraying the insane and rarefied world of German professor Dr. Moritz Maria von Igelfeld of the Institute of Romance Philology. Alexander has also written standalone novels and collections of short stories, as well as children's books. His newest children's books are based on the adventures as a little girl of the star of the number one ladies detective agency series, the beloved Precious Ramotswe. Alexander is now Professor Emeritus at the University of Edinburgh and holds honorary doctorates from 12 universities. In 2007, he was made a CBE for his services to literature in the Queen's New Year Honours List. He's a Fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, the Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh, the Academy of Medical Sciences, and Senior Fellow of Massey College. In addition to his university work, McCall Smith was for 4 years the Vice Chairman of the Human Genetics Commission of the UK, the Chairman of the British Medical Journal Ethics Committee, and a member of the International Bioethics Commission of UNESCO. He is the recipient of numerous awards, including the Presidential Order of Merit by the President of Botswana. Alexander has fans all over the world, including former First Lady of the United States, Laura Bush, and Flea of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. The latest installment of the number one ladies detective agency, The Woman Who Walked in Sunshine, is coming out on October 27th. Welcome to the show, Alexander.
Hello.
Well, thank you so much for calling in from Britain. We appreciate that.
Yes, that's fine.
You are a prolific and wonderfully creative writer. I'm wondering if you can remember the first book or books that really affected you and made you aware of the artistic power of writing.
I suppose it must have been books that I read when I was a child. I was a voracious reader when I was a child, as many children are, and I remember being very taken with certain stories. One of them I remember very clearly was Rudyard Kipling's Rikki-Tikki-Tavi, which is a wonderful story, and that made a big impression on me when I think I was really quite young. But I also read quite a lot of poetry as a child, and I think that that had its effect as well. So looking back, I would probably be able to find a lot of books and a lot of writers who had an effect on me.
Right, yes. Do you feel you grew up in a creative environment?
Yes, I think so, in the sense that there were books in the house, which is really the most important thing to develop, if you want to develop an interest in reading in children. And I think that we had that. We had quite a lot of books in the house, and I always loved just browsing through them and reading. So I think that's the way in which we become book lovers.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's impossible to become a writer, really, without also being an avid reader, I think. Would you agree?
I think it would be hard. I suppose it could be done. But I think that you have to have a feeling for words if you want to be a writer. You can acquire that, of course, by reading and by practicing. Writing, in a sense, is the same as any other pursuit, and you can practice it and get better at it. But I think that if you've had long-term exposure to books and to literature in general, then yes, it's going to be it's going to rub off.
Yes, yeah. You started your career in medical law and academia. I'm wondering what drew you to that area?
Well, I studied law at university and I was going to be a lawyer. I ended up being a legal academic, and I found myself increasingly interested in the interface between law and medicine. And I came to that, I suppose, initially through criminal law, where there were issues of responsibility and accountability connected with things like the insanity defense, for example. And that led to a deeper interest in the subject. And I found that there were just so many things in medical law, in that particular connection between law and medicine, that really fascinated me. So I ended up doing that, and I served on quite a number of committees and commissions all over the place, dealing with some of these issues of the relationship between law and medicine. I was for a number of years on the UNESCO Bioethics Commission, which was very interesting work. That was which had responsibility for the International Declaration on the Human Genome. So it was all very, very interesting. And in a way, I was rather sad to give it up when I decided to become a full-time writer.
Right, yes, I can imagine. I mean, the whole area of ethics surrounding medicine and science in general, I mean, we're pushing the envelope with that right now, aren't we, with all the development with different projects like cloning and the use of embryonic tissue and things like that.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that every time science makes a leap forward, we suddenly realize that there are ethical implications to it. I think that by and large, we manage to keep science ethical, but there are things that I suppose set warning bells ringing. I think that we have to realize that the more we know about the human body, the more we know about our genes, for example, then the more we know about people as people. That means that we have to consider questions of confidentiality surrounding information that we have on people, that sort of thing.
Yes, yeah, and I often think we've created ethical dilemmas for ourselves with, you know, this pursuit of life at all costs. You know, we've put sort of choices before ourselves that didn't exist in the past, of whether someone should live or die because they can be kept alive and things like that. It's sort of, there seems to always be a double-edged sword kind of effect with progress.
I think that that's quite right. I think that as we become better at dealing with disease, we obviously extend people's lives. And it's now possible, through medical intervention, to keep people alive well beyond the limits that I suppose nature would have imposed in the past. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't do it, but I think that does raise issues about how far we keep treating people when that treatment isn't going to be particularly productive, and it might just prolong a life that, if nature took its course, would have ended some time ago. Now, that, it's a very tricky issue. I certainly don't advocate euthanasia, positive euthanasia. I'm definitely not in favour of that. I think that we need to preserve the prohibition on taking human life. I think that that's a very, very valuable prohibition. But I think we need to have a sense of perspective, and so there may be circumstances in which, in a way, it becomes cruel to prolong somebody's life when their quality of life is very bad, when they may not be aware of what's going on around them, and so on. I just think that that's our interfering in the normal course of nature.
Yes, and I think also at the other end of life, we're enabling life to begin and perpetuate with babies and young children that in the past wouldn't have survived, which creates another whole range of ethical considerations as well.
That's right. I think that there are problems at that end as well. I mean, there are certain circumstances in which one might say that a child who is very, very badly damaged and doesn't have much prospect of a reasonable life, one wonders about pursuing aggressive treatment in those circumstances. But those, of course, are very, very tricky. Very emotive. I think, generally speaking, in the past, the medical profession has felt its way through these issues in a humane way. The difficulty is that when the medical profession starts to get frightened about litigation or about potential criminal liability or something of that sort, then they may say, well, you know, we can't use our judgment here, and we've got to throw absolutely everything, all our resources, at a particular case in order to avoid being blamed for the loss of somebody.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, this all is obviously a very meaningful part of your life, which you were very engaged in. What first inspired you to try your hand at writing fiction?
Well, I always wrote in my spare time. I remember that I sent off my first manuscript to a publisher when I was 8 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
a bit of a nerve. I presumably wrote it out in capital letters with a pencil or whatever and sent it off, and was very excited about that. And I actually got a letter back from the publisher who said,
oh, brilliant.
Thank you very much. Yeah, so it was very kind of him. Thank you very much for sending your manuscript. I'm sorry that we won't be able to publish it, but do carry on writing. What a wonderful thing for a publisher to do, to write back to a child of eight and encourage him. And of course, you know, it may have been very different had he written back and said, don't waste my time or waste your time, or had he totally ignored it.
Yes.
I may then have felt, well, writing was not for me. But anyway, I persisted, and I wrote, written since then. I always did it in my spare time when I had other things to do. When I was being a university professor, in my spare time I was a writer, which is often the case. Writers have to have a day job, so to speak. That was certainly the case with me.
Ah, very interesting. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest this week, one of the world's most prolific and popular best-selling authors, Alexander McCall Smith. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
The music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Oh, she's black, but steamer lane.
It's a Question of Balance music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts, Alexander McCall-Smith. And we heard in the break there from Bookshop Santa Cruz, and I wanted to let local listeners know that Bookshop Santa Cruz is presenting a special off-site event with Alexander McCall-Smith on the 9th of November at 7 p.m. It's going to be at the Peace United Church. It's expected to be extremely popular, so you do need to get your tickets in advance, and you can get them at Bookshop Santa Cruz store or from their website, bookshopsantacruz.com. So again, that's the 9th of November at 7 p.m. Hope you can go. I will be going, so it's a great opportunity to hear and see Alexander McCall-Smith in person. And also just let you know, if you want more information about Alexander and all his many books, you can go to his website, Alexander McCall-Smith, and that is McCall with two C's, M-C-C-A-L-L. So, Alexander, I wanted to ask you, the name of your best-selling series, the number one detective, ladies detective agency, might give the new reader the idea that the books are about murder mysteries, but as Janet Malcolm says in the New York Times, there are no murders in them and little suspense. When asked about what the agency does, Ma Makutsi, Ma Ramotswe's assistant, replies, as a psychoanalyst might, "Most of the time we are just helping people to find out things they already know." I was wondering what gave you the idea of a detective agency that deals more with the emotional problems of life.
Well, I really hadn't intended when I started writing these books to make them anything to do with detection. but I had Mara Motswe contemplating what she should do with a small inheritance that she'd received from her father. And she says, "Oh, well, I know, I'll start a detective agency," because she thought that there wasn't one and it would be quite a good idea to have one. I think her real desire was to help people with the problems in their lives, as she says. And that, I think, was quite a good vehicle for me to write about a country and its people and the sort of things that they experience in their day-to-day lives. Because one of the attractive features of a detective agency, obviously, is that people can wander in, all sorts of people can wander in, and say, "I've got a problem, can you help me?" And that would enable the writer to write about what is going on in the country, to paint a picture of the lives of people in the country. And that really was my reasoning. And then I started to write, and I rather discovered that I liked the characters. And, of course, this was a very good way of bringing in all sorts of subsidiary characters who were the clients of the detective agency. But no crime, or very little crime. It's usually just mysteries of some sort, bad behavior, missing people, that sort of thing. We don't go in the number one ladies' detective agency, we don't go in for murder or anything like that.
Right. I was wondering what your process was way back at the beginning for starting this series. It sounds like it was the characters that came to you first.
It was the characters and the country, because the country in those books, the country of Botswana, is a character as well. It's a remarkable country. And the people I write about, I think, are really rather wonderful people. So I really wanted to portray the people of this this great country, Botswana.
I wanted to ask you, actually, because you spent your early life in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. What was it that led you to set the series in Botswana rather than Zimbabwe?
Well, I had worked in Botswana back in 1981. I was there as a member of staff at the University of Botswana. I was seconded from my home university in Edinburgh in Scotland. And I realized that this was an exceptional place, and I found it an intriguing society. Mm. And I think that is why I decided to write about it. I suppose another reason is that Botswana is a country that people don't necessarily know a great deal about, or certainly didn't at that stage know a great deal about it. And I thought this was such a fantastic success story, Botswana, what they'd done, what they'd achieved, that it was worth writing about it. So everything pointed to setting the series in Botswana, and I'm very glad that I did.
Mm. You have a very strong female character in Precious Ramotswe in the number one ladies detective agency, and also Isabel Dalhousie in the Sunday Philosophy Club series. How do you get yourself into the female mind to create realistic women?
Well, I think that as an author, you have to be prepared to contemplate what it is to be a very different sort of person.
Mm.
So you have to be able to put yourself into the shoes of somebody who's had a different background, different experiences, who's maybe done very different things from what one's done oneself.
Mm.
And so therefore I think that it's possible for male authors to write about women and for women authors to write about men.
Mm.
I think it's interesting that people tend not to comment on a woman writing about male characters, but when you get a man writing about female characters, then it becomes a subject of comment. Maybe it's just that there are fewer men doing that. I suspect that's probably the case. But I think that we should be able to understand what it is to be somebody quite different.
Yeah, maybe because there's that sort of popular myth that men are always bemused about the workings of women's minds. You know, it's a sort of out there as a, almost like a stereotype. Perhaps that's why, you know, people comment on men writing about women.
Possibly. I don't know. I mean, I think that certainly it's the case that men and women do tend to talk about different things amongst themselves. I think male conversation and female conversation can differ.
Mm.
I think one of the reasons why I like writing about women is that I find female conversation very interesting. Men can sometimes be a little bit more inhibited in their conversation. Women are more prepared to discuss their emotions than perhaps men generally are. Now, of course, these are vast generalizations on my part, but I think there is a bit of a difference.
No, I think that's a fair comment. In your latest book, The Woman Who Walked in Sunshine, Ma Ramotswe contemplates as follows. "We have lost so much," she thought. "Our dear country has lost so much. But everybody has lost something. It was not just Botswana, which had perhaps lost less than others. So many people had lost that sense of identification with the land that gave meaning to life, that fixed one firmly to a place one loved. At least we still have that," she thought. "At least we still have the land that we can call our place. Acacia trees that are our acacia trees. A sky that is our sky because it watched over our mothers and fathers and took them up into it, embraced them when they became late. We still have that, no matter how big and frightening the world becomes." I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the current, particularly Western immersion in a digital virtual world that seems very far away from this sense of having a place in the natural world so beautifully described here.
Well, thank you. I think I probably would feel that this virtual world that we create for ourselves, in which there are no boundaries and there's no real sense of being fixed, is obviously has some advantages in that it has opened up all sorts of new vistas to people.
Mm.
Indeed, some people say it's made us really four-dimensional. that there's a fourth dimension that we have to our lives. I think that probably is true, but with everything that you gain, you lose something, I think, and that's really what Mara Matsui is saying there. So she would say, you gain things through new technology, you gain things by drifting to the cities. I mean, she's mainly talking about urbanization, people leaving the land and going to live in the cities. And what do they gain when they go to the cities? Well, their standard of living goes up. They gain greater access to education and health and various other things. They may be safer, although that's not necessarily the case, but there may be things, very clear advantages in it. But, of course, there is the other side of the coin, and they're losing the intimacy of living in a village or living in the country, and that's very, very important. Mm. You know your neighbours. You know the people around you. You grow up with people and you continue to see them. And then you move to a city, you lead a very different sort of life. Virtually everybody is a stranger to you. Mm. So we lose those human bonds, that sense of being part of a human community. That's very important. Now, I think one can't really reverse urbanization. It's a universal phenomenon. But I think sometimes we can reflect on how we've lost a community, how we also may feel that we've lost control over our lives, because in very large societies where decisions are taken elsewhere, distantly, and we don't control them. I mean, look at the way in which in our lives today, the things about us are often things from very far away. Mm. So in the past, the physical objects that you had about you were things that were made nearby or made perhaps not too far away. Mm. Now everything is imported from a vast distance. It's all standardized. And so that sense of connection with place has been lost. Take food, for example. We used to eat the things that were accessible to us that we could get from our surroundings. Or we also had things that were in season. That's been lost. Mm. And now we can eat absolutely anything. Everything's there available for us. And in a way, greater choice, greater possibilities, but at the same time, loss of connection, loss of sense of ownership of things.
Yes. I mean, when I read that particular passage, I just had sort of shivers, and for me what it really spoke to, and of course this is why art is so wonderful, because it can communicate, you know, different things to different people and on different levels, but I really was feeling about being part of the web of life. I think, you know, the more we advance, it seems, the more we kind of raise ourselves above the rest of nature, like we're discrete from that. And that sort of, you just described so beautifully how we are or can be just a part of the natural world as well, which I think.
Yes, I think we're detaching ourselves from the real world, from the natural world, and I think that has certain consequences. The other thing which is rather interesting is that we experience a lot of very rapid change these days. Because the landscape around us is changing so dramatically. Buildings don't last very long. So you think that you know a street, or you think that you know a town or a city, and then suddenly you turn a corner and everything has changed. The old buildings have gone, the roads gone. So all the features of our physical world that used to, be landmarks for us, are threatened. There's a very, rather interesting word which has been developed by an Australian philosopher, which is solastalgia. It's a rather nice word, rather like nostalgia, but a little bit different. And solastalgia, he says, is the sense of sadness that comes upon people when their physical surroundings change too quickly. And this particular professor studied this in the case of a couple of communities in Australia where there had been dramatic change in the physical surroundings of these people. So in one case it was strip mining had removed hills, had removed geographical features, and in another case it was very prolonged drought had killed the vegetation, and so everything had dried up, withered and died. And the people in these circumstances just felt sad. They weren't necessarily clinically depressed. But they were sad. They were cast down by this, and they had a sense of sadness that the world had somehow changed on them. And I think that that's rather interesting, because we do feel, I think, that loss when the familiar is replaced.
Yes, yeah. No, I think that's very true. The Chicago Sun-Times says of your work, utterly enchanting. It's impossible to come away from an Alexander McCall Smith novel without a smile on the lips and warm fuzzies in the heart. I was wondering, is creating a life-affirming experience through your writing important to you, even whilst dealing with difficult life issues?
Well, I think that when I write, I don't necessarily have an agenda, so to speak. I don't sit down and say, the reason why I'm writing is that I want to do X or Y.
Mm.
I think it's certainly the case that I hope that when people read my books that they'll come to the last page and they'll shut the book, close the book, and they will feel better than when they were, than they felt when they started.
Yes.
I think that's quite important to me, because I feel that I'm a writer who operates at the more, perhaps, a affirmative end of the spectrum.
Yes.
So I'm not writing about the bleak. Now, the bleak exists.
Mm.
I'm not saying that the world isn't a vale of tears in many respects, and I'm not saying that there isn't considerable dysfunction and confrontation and unhappiness and all the things we know exist. Those obviously have to be reflected in literature. But I think that there's a role for books that are saying, well, let's consider the beauty of the world. Let's consider how good people can be. Without, you know, being Pollyanna-ish about it, and without, you know, turning one's face against any form of reflection on sadness or dysfunction, but just actually stressing how things can actually be really rather beautiful and moving and inspiring. And of course, there's a lot of that.
Yes.
You know, if you read the papers these days, or you watch the television news, or whatever, you think that the world is coming to an end. I mean, all the news is so depressing.
Absolutely.
But all sorts of wonderful things are happening at the same time. And as we go through life, we see this. We meet people who inspire us. There are lots of instances of human kindness, human decency.
Yeah.
There are lots of people who are leading really constructive, good lives. So I think it's acceptable as an author to say, let's take a look at that.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And I think there is, a big gap, which luckily you are, you know, partially filling with all your work. Because I remember going into the local bookstore and saying, I want a book that, you know, has a kind of positive, affirming, you know, feel when you end it. And they really, really, really struggled to recommend anything.
Yes, well, that's the problem. I think that we've just got so used to entertaining ourselves with murder and mayhem and all sorts of awful things, we forget that there are other things that can be even more entertaining.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special guest from the arts, best-selling author Alexander McCall Smith. We're going to go to a break now. We'll be back very soon after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Danielle and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Nevada's wild horses are disappearing from our rangelands at an alarming rate. Every day, horses are rounded up, captured, sold, and sent off to be cruelly slaughtered for food overseas. The horses you see out your window today could end up on someone's dinner plate tomorrow. We simply must do something to save them. This great country was built on the backs of the horses. They helped us plow our fields, pull our wagons, and they deserve all the dignity and respect afforded other American icons. The horse helped us craft this nation we know and revere today. This is country music star Lacey J. Dalton. I have dedicated my life to save Nevada's wild horses, but I cannot save them without your help. Your generous donations are the only chance some of these horses have. Visit letemrun.com for more information. Join me. Nevada's wild horses are disappearing from our rangelands at an alarming rate. Visit letemrun.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, one of the world's most prolific and popular best-selling authors, Alexander McCall Smith. And I just wanted to remind you again that for local listeners, Alexander is going to be in Santa Cruz on November the 9th at an event sponsored by Bookshop Santa Cruz to talk about his new book in the number one ladies detective agency series, The Woman Who Walked in Sunshine. You will need to get tickets in advance. It's going to be a very popular event, so you can get them from Bookshop Santa Cruz or from bookshopsantacruz.com, and I'll be going, so I hope to see you there. And before the break, we were talking about positivity and life-affirming literature. And in The Woman Who Walked in Sunshine, the new book, Alexander, you write that Mara Motswe was of the opinion that things were getting better, even if there were temporary setbacks, and even if there was very little light at the end of the tunnel, she would not slip into a position that failed to see any progress in human affairs. And it sounds like that does reflect your own attitude of life.
Would yes, you say? I think so. I think that there are many respects in which things are getting better. We're making great progress. I think we've got to be terribly careful to not to contemplate the world and say things are really, really awful. I mean, they may be to an extent, but I think we have to bear in mind that there is the other side to it, which is that we've made great moral progress. If you look at the way in which, generally speaking, we're much more aware now of people's feelings than we used to be. Look at the progress that we've made in the last 50, 60 years in human rights, for example. We're far more aware of people's human rights, their legitimate claims. So that's good progress. Also, think of the tremendous progress that was made in over a slightly longer period with the abolition of slavery. You know, it's not all that long ago that the world knew slavery of various sorts. That's now a thing of the past, although I must say this, there are still forms of slavery which are being practiced. There's still an anti-slavery society that has quite a lot of work to do with people who are trapped in dreadful contracts, employment contracts, and trafficking of people, and so on. But we have made great progress in the small things of life as well.
Yes,
remember how people how at school people used to give other people cruel nicknames. That's much rarer now.
Yes,
we're more aware of bullying. You know, we know that that it happens. Obviously, we're never going to be able to get rid of it entirely, but we're much more aware of it. And so you'd say that people's freedoms have been considerably enhanced. I suppose we've made progress in We've made education progress. We've made progress in helping people suffering from cruel diseases. You know, we cure so many more things, and all of that is good and is very very positive. A lot of people in the last few decades have been lifted out of poverty throughout the world.
Yeah,
another good thing. So I think it's a question of balance in this world. We see some things which are worrying and which are bad, but others which are really very positive.
Yes, yeah, and I always think that, you know, you look around and like you said in the media, there's just so much conflict, and obviously there is a lot of horrible stuff going on, but I always think it's a massive achievement that so many hundreds of millions of people in the world are living together, you know, without conflict and, you know, without much threat either. You know, I mean, that seems, when you just look at America, for instance, you know, however many, 300 plus million people generally living together peaceably.
Yes.
That seems...
No, I agree. I think we need to remind ourselves of these positive things.
Yes, absolutely. There's a strong feminist thread in the books reflected through strong female characters and cultural observations. In The Company of Cheerful Ladies, you write, all women in Botswana were the victims of the fecklessness of men. And there's a very high rate of HIV in Africa, largely due to the promiscuity of men, which you allude to at times. And I've read Botswana in particular has a 40% rate of HIV. And so I'm wondering what you're hoping to convey through your writing about the place of women in Africa and in the wider world.
Well, I think that women's position has been tremendously improved over the last few decades in many African countries. In the past, women weren't allowed to play their full role in society in many of these countries, and I think that has been whittled away, which is great. So you'll see women succeeding in business and women succeeding in politics and so on, doing very well, because women in traditional African societies did great things. I mean, they had a lot on their hands. They had to sort of till the fields as well as looking after the children, that sort of thing. But I think that women have really enjoyed making great strides in that respect. You mentioned HIV. I think, in fact, the infection rate is a bit lower than the rate that you mentioned.
Right.
It's still worryingly high in many sub-Saharan African countries, and that's a great tragedy because they were just making great progress in dealing with infectious disease, and then along comes this great health tragedy. And I think also, from the point of view of men, I don't think one can always blame men for behaving in an irresponsible way.
No, that's true, because they're doing it with someone.
Exactly. Yes. You know, there is that expression, it takes two to tango.
Yes.
So I think I would want to defend men from being vested with the sole responsibility for that problem. However, that problem is an issue in these African countries. I think obviously there's still work for women to do in dealing with some of the problems that still persist. Some of the issues of male domination that still exist need to be looked at. But generally speaking, the movement is towards gender equality, which is I think a good thing.
Yes. You've written a number of different series. I'm wondering what appeals to you about the serial form.
Well, I really like going back to characters that I've encountered in a previous book. That gives me great pleasure because you feel you know them, and I look forward to each year to my literary conversation with my characters. It's great fun going back to a place that you visited in a previous book. So I do a lot of serial novels. I've got my number one Lady Detective Agency series. I've got my Isabel Dalhousie series, the Sunday Philosophy Club series, as it's also known. I've got a series called Scotland Street, which has had 10 volumes so far. And that is a newspaper serial, which becomes a book. That's set in Edinburgh, where I live in Scotland, and I've had great fun with that. Interestingly enough, that series started after a conversation I'd had in San Francisco, on a visit to San Francisco. Quite a few years ago, I was at a literary party, and one of the guests was Armistead Maupeou, who wrote the Tales of the City in the San Francisco Chronicle. And I had a conversation with him, and he said, you know, make sure that you never write a serial novel in a newspaper. And I went home and did just that. But I do acknowledge my debt to his example, because that was a long-running one in the San Francisco Chronicle. And the one that I do appears in the Scotsman newspaper and then comes out as a book. And I really like that, because there I publish a chapter a day.
Yeah, well, that's sort of going back to the sort of Dickens era of doing it, yeah.
Yeah, now that's how novelists worked in the past. Dickens being a very good example of that, with his 12,000-word chapters that he published every month or whatever it was. And people get really really excited about finding out what their favourite characters are doing. It's rather like, say, a soap opera on television. You're always interested in finding out what people are up to.
Yeah, absolutely. You've worked in academia and in the arts, and you write non-fiction and fiction. Do you feel they each inform the other, or are you going back and forth between your left and right brain as appropriate?
Well, I think they are quite different in a way. I'm not sure whether my writing style when I'm writing fiction is influenced at all by my writing non-fiction. I think that they do involve, probably, as you say, different bits of the brain. I think that writing fiction, one sits back and gains access to one's subconscious mind, which often makes stories up. That, I think, is rather different from writing non-fiction, where you're thinking about facts and you're very much, more aware of what's going on and having to be more careful. With fiction, you can sort of dream away, and up will come the story.
Yes, yeah. We're coming towards the end of the show, but I wanted to ask you about the Great Tapestry of Scotland, which you produced with historian Alastair Moffat and with the artistic talents of Andrew Crummie and more than a thousand stitchers. It's the world's longest tapestry telling the history of Scotland through one of the biggest community arts projects ever to take place in Scotland. Can you tell us a bit about your inspiration for this project?
Well, that's a wonderful tapestry. As you say, it's the longest tapestry in the world. It's crewel work, which involves stitching onto to linen, a particular form of tapestry. I had seen a tapestry designed by an artist called Andrew Crummie. This was on display in Edinburgh, and I thought, what a wonderful tapestry it was. And so I decided to ask him whether he would do a tapestry on the whole history of Scotland, showing the whole history of Scotland from the Ice Age onwards.
Gosh.
He said yes. And so we just launched into it, and we got over 1,000 volunteers who stitched these various panels. Each panel, most of the panels are about a yard by a yard, a meter square, so to speak. And they are so beautiful. Andrew's drawings, designs are really wonderful, and it brought people together for a long time. People were able then to work together to collaborate on telling this lovely story of Scottish history, and the result is just so beautiful, it takes the breath away. I mean, I've seen people looking at it. It's been touring the country, going all through Scotland, being shown in various places. And I've seen people looking at it in tears of emotion. They're just so moved by it. It's monumental. Something really special about tapestry, because it's tactile. It's a lovely way of showing a picture or telling a story through a picture. You want to touch it. It's tactile, because we discourage people from touching it,
right?
Because it wouldn't do much good.
Yeah.
But it's been a great success, and we're going to be building a special museum for it in the Scottish Borders, which is a part of Scotland which is particularly associated with the textile industry anyway. And this is going to be a great tourist attraction. It's really is tremendous fun. I suspect that people will be commissioning more tapestries in the future when they see what a nice way it is of telling a story.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's so few community projects like that these days, and yet when you take part in something like that, I mean, it is so engaging and just fun to work with other people on something creative, isn't it?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. It is just immense fun working with other people on a creative project. So these groups of stitchers were about 8 to 10 people, and all sorts of friendships were made. And they had a wonderful time, and I think many of them felt really bereft when they reached the end of it, because they had so enjoyed working with one another. It's rather like making music together.
Mm.
I think being in an amateur orchestra is tremendous fun. It's or a band of some sort. There's nothing to beat artistic collaboration with other people.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Alexander. It's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you very much indeed. I've enjoyed our conversation a great deal.
Wonderful. Well, I wish you all the best on your book tour. And just to remind listeners again that Alexander, if you're local, is going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz event at the Peace United Church on November the 9th at 7 p.m. And you do need to get tickets in advance for that. It's expected to sell out. So you can get those from Bookshop Santa Cruz or from bookshopsantacruz.com. And if you're listening from outside this area, if you go to Alexander McCall Smith's website, I'm sure there's information about other places in America that he's going to be, so you may be able to catch him near you, meet him in person, talking about his new book in the number one ladies detective agency series, The Woman Who Walked in Sunshine. And as I said, I'll be going, so I really hope to see you there. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. Remember that you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, and hear podcasts there of all previous shows. If you've enjoyed this show, do tell your friends about it and send them to the website. They'll be able to hear the podcast there. And we've had some other great guests in the past and some really interesting topics. So I encourage you to go to itsaquestionofbalance.com and also connect with me on social media, should you wish. Hope you have a good week.